Welcome to All In, the Sustainable Business Podcast. Three veterans of sustainability, David Grayson, Chris Coulter, and Mark Lee, take you behind the scenes of the most innovative and exciting aspects of business today.
Welcome, everyone, to the next episode of the All In Sustainable Business Podcast. Delighted, as always, to have you here to listen to us and really excited about who we're going to have a conversation with today. David and I are reflecting mid-spring, end of May now, on all that 2022 has already brought. And there was a seminal event on the calendar just in this last week. Davos, unusually, happened in May instead of in its normal snowy winter environment, given the impacts of the pandemic again on people's ability to gather. And someone we've known and admired in the field for an awfully long time, Rob Cameron, who is the global head of public affairs and ESG engagement at Nestle, was at Davos this last week here at the end of May, leading into the Memorial Day weekend in the US. We're going to talk to Rob about all things sustainability and how to work sustainably at Nestle. And we're also going to pick his brain on what happened there in the mountains in Switzerland, get a sense of the global issues that are, again, helping define and redefine the work that we do in this field. So glad you've joined us for this next episode of the podcast. We are going to move on and launch that conversation with Rob. David and I have the pleasure today to be engaging the longtime friend and colleague, Rob Cameron, who is the global head of public affairs and ESG engagement at Nestle. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks, Mark. Good to see you. Good to see you too, David. Glad to be here.
Rob, you've had kind of a big week. I think you've spent it at Davos. Davos has been running for more than half a century now, I think. And it's been, in many ways over the years, a celebration of globalization, or at least a hearty conversation about globalization's benefits and how it might advance. And this year, some of that has felt more under challenge, at least from a distance. Some of the media I read was using words like the angsty feeling at Davos, the concerns at Davos, the breakdown of globalization. And we see this in challenges to supply chains from the pandemic. We see this with the war in Ukraine. We see this with questions about economies everywhere and inflation. So you were there. What was the mood on the ground? What were people talking about?
Yeah. Angsty, in a word. You said it. I mean, from my point of view, it's the first time I'd been, and I wasn't quite so sure what to expect. And I was there from Sunday night through Wednesday late. All I can say is that one way of summarizing it is that there were three C's that continue to dominate. The three C's, obviously the first one being COVID. And whilst for many of us, it feels like, well, that crisis passed finally, didn't it? In many ways, it hasn't, especially if you happen to be in China. And that's affecting the global perspective quite considerably for obvious reasons. So that's the first thing. The second thing was climate. And the climate crisis was everywhere, rightly so, of course. So the third, of course, being conflict. And let's not call it conflict, really. I mean, it's nice to have the alliteration of three C's, but let's call it an invasion. And that conflict is having huge consequences. And I think in many ways, these three things are really impacting on each other. Throw in inflation, throw in supply chain disruption, et cetera. And you've got something that for many people there was deeply concerning. And I think one of the ways in which it's concerning is that quite serious people were talking about civil unrest, the consequences of this.
That's your fourth C.
Well, it could keep going because this is, of course, cyclical or a vicious circle. Yeah, it keeps going. But the possibility of civil unrest is starting to be talked about in the context of the Arab Spring and what we saw there. So, you know, it's pretty grim in that regard. I think, though, if you want to try and pick some crumbs of comfort in all of this, and I wouldn't say it's much more than a crumb, but at least there's something to hang your hat on. What I found was often happening was that whereas previously one might have found oneself at any kind of one of these big set-piece conferences talking about climate change or talking about supply chain or talking about COVID crisis, the interconnectivity of this, of these systems is starting to be understood better. You know, one way of looking at it is that you and I have been talking about system change for about 20 years. But what we know is that systems really reveal themselves much more vividly and the interdependencies and the impacts when they're under challenge, when they're threatened. And all of our systems are fundamentally threatened now. And we start to see these impacts and dependencies in ways that perhaps we hadn't seen previously. And that opens up conversations that I just don't think would have happened otherwise.
You've been watching those systems for decades, as you said, Rob, and here you were watching them under stress. in some ways, that first report took the angsty side of Davos. Were there conversations there that excited you as well? Did you walk away with some spring in your step?
I wouldn't say spring in my step, but I think there's a couple of things that certainly did have me thinking, well, maybe, just maybe. I mean, firstly, the fact that the systems are being looked at in that more integrated way. Regeneration is a theme that it was very, very present. Somebody pointed out that they'd never even heard the word used at Davos before. And yet it was one of the themes, certainly in the rooms that I was in, there was an awful lot of talk about regeneration. And I'm very, very excited about what that could bring, that way of looking at things. Another way in which we might find some comfort is the role of the private sector and collaboration across the NGO community, governments, and the private sector. And I think the importance of the private sector perhaps is being understood differently now in the light of the conflict. So I think that there's something there. And then I think the third thing for me in terms of this is that it's just physically getting together and seeing people again. You know, that kind of, oh, what are you working on? The kind of corridor conversation that you just haven't been able to have for the longest time. And I think there was a bit of energy there. There's some energy that we were finding that you certainly can't get when you're just speaking to people on Zoom. So excited, not really, but certainly there are some things going on there that could give us at least a crumb of hope.
So I think we could spend the entire conversation unpicking some of those big issues from Davos, and I'm absolutely certain that we're going to come back in subsequent podcasts to some of those questions. I'm just finishing off at the moment a history of business in the community for its first 40 years for a big celebration next month. And of course, although the origins of business in the community were before the riots in the inner cities in the United Kingdom in 1981, those riots undoubtedly gave a huge extra push and created a great sense of urgency for the establishment of what is now one of the very oldest and most substantial of the world's corporate responsibility coalitions. It's so important for us to really understand what our guests are grappling with in their day jobs. And you have this fascinating title of global head, not just of public affairs, but also of ESG engagement. I'd love to unpick a bit. That's an unusual title. I've not heard that combination before. So just explain to us, if you would, how that combination of roles and very explicit title has come about, and how you see the interplay between your job as head of Global Head of Public Affairs and your job as Global Head of ESG Engagement.
That's interesting, David, that you teed it up for Rob as a question about two jobs, but let's see what Rob does with that.
Actually, that's a short form version. There is actually an even longer form version of it, would you believe? But look, the point is this. Nestle isn't particularly well known for this, but the fact is that I am the third person to take this job that comes with either an NGO or a similar sort of background. My predecessor prior was Christian Frutiger, who joined Nestle from the ICRC, was not a public affairs professional. His predecessor was Janet Voet, who joined from the World Heart Federation, was not a public affairs professional. And I had this very conversation only this week in Davos, pointing out that I have the job title of Global Head of Public Affairs, and frankly, I'm not a public affairs professional, never have been, and not likely to become one anytime soon. The point is that at Nestle, public affairs and sustainability are effectively the same thing, the way we have it structured. So there are some occasions when I might get brought into or might have to deal with some other aspects that fall outside of the sustainability agenda. One way of looking at it, if you look at my team, within my team around me, reporting up to me, I have someone who's responsible for packaging and plastics, and the issues around that, climate, biodiversity and water, issues around that, human rights, food and nutrition, and then stakeholder engagement. Those are my direct reports. Everything that we do is really around the sustainability agenda. And that's frankly the reason why I took the job. Now, this is an unusual thing about Nestle. In order to bring something a little bit more structured to it, I've been there 2.5 years and the changes we have wrought, I really stress we, to put more delivery into it have been phenomenal. So the first thing is, I mean, just very obviously change the title from public affairs to public affairs and ESG engagement. And that, well, it could have been sustainability, it could have been something else, but you work with the words that people are using. We've set up, from a governance point of view, a sustainability committee of the board. So that didn't exist before. It was bundled up with nominations. We've now got separate governance. Internally, we have what we call the ESG Council, which is a bunch of people from our executive board responsible for delivery of our key sustainability commitments. We have an ESG Strategy and Deployment Unit sitting in operations run by Antonia Vanna. And if you were to fuse Antonia and I together into one being, you would have something like a chief sustainability officer. But I can tell you, as far as I can see, Nestle will never have a single chief sustainability officer, because the idea is to make it part of the other functions so that it's fully embedded into the business. I mean, that's the structural side of it. And then there's all the other stuff that we've worked on since I got here that we've been making good strides on. But just to clarify, it's a bit of a misnomer, this job title, which is why I wanted to bring that ESG term into it. So to give me a little bit of a sense of, as the rest of the world moves on with CSOs and so on, that I'm part of that conversation, not part of a public affairs in the purest sense of the word conversation. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense, and fascinating that a global business like a Nestle is saying, okay, we understand for some other businesses, the chief sustainability officer route may be the one to go down, but that's not for us. We've got a different way of doing it, which is much more, we believe, going with the grain of our Nestle culture. Rob, I think you started to answer my next question inadvertently when you talked about some of your direct reports and what their areas of responsibility are. So when you talked about plastic and innovation and food and nutrition and stakeholder engagement and so on. But what would you see as being the issues on the radar screen or on the materiality matrix of Nestle? Because you're one of the businesses that is very public on your website about your materiality matrix. What are some of the big issues that you see as becoming even more important in the last few months?
In terms of the big issues, climate is just so important to us. And we wanted to take a leading role on climate. And we went out with our net zero 2050 pledge some time ago now. And in fact, actually, we've also passed peak carbon now as well. There's no going back now. We're absolutely determined that this is going to be done chiefly through reductions and also some removals, but chiefly through reductions. We've got a great opportunity. So many of our emissions are scope three emissions. 80% of our emissions are scope three. And of those, the vast majority are in agriculture. And of course, dairy, for instance, is huge there. Net zero, yes, we've passed peak carbon. Now we're on a downward trajectory, even as the company grows. That is a huge issue for us. And one of the things that we've also done, which I'm really pleased about, is that we've really put some effort into this. I mentioned earlier on about regeneration. Our aim is to advance regenerative food systems at scale. That's easy to say, and you could have a long conversation about, okay, so what do we mean by a regenerative food system? But what we do know is we know something about how we can define regenerative agriculture. So that regen ag piece for us is tremendously important, and we're putting some serious money into it. So 1.2 billion Swiss francs is being invested in regenerative agriculture to stimulate the transition with farmers directly over the course of the next 3 years. So huge commitment there, with the aim of 20% of our agricultural produce being sourced from regenerative practices by 2025 and 50% by 2030. So that's huge for us. I can't emphasize enough how much effort is going into that. And then there's the other issues that, I mean, I've already mentioned some of them, plastics and packaging. You know, we've got big commitments for 2025 on design for recycling and recyclability, working on forests with our Forest Positive initiative. Deforestation is what we're trying to stop. We wanted to look at it different ways. What are we trying to achieve? And that's why we've come up with the Forest Positive initiative. Ending deforestation is an a priori sort of necessity, but that only fixes the problem as in it's fixed for today. It doesn't solve the causes of deforestation, hence Forest Positive. Then there's the water agenda, of course. There's the human rights agenda, and we've just launched our human rights framework, which we've developed over the last year or so. We've got big issues around child labour, I think many people know, which is why we've just launched what we call the Income Accelerator in Cocoa. Any materiality analysis always has human rights and child labour right up there. The Income Accelerator, I think, is one of the most novel ways of addressing child labour in cocoa that's ever been attempted. And it's hugely, hugely costly as well, I can tell you. But rightly so, you know, we've got to invest in these things. All of these things we know about anyway. We can have them affirmed through the materiality analysis, but we know we've got them anyway. With the materiality analysis, specifically in terms of why do you do it, one of the key things for us there is that the materiality analysis can highlight the shifts in importance. We know that certain issues are always going to be important, but what is their relative importance? And what is going on with regard to capital allocations, resource allocations, strategic decision making, and so on? And the way in which we do it is aligned with our enterprise risk management folk. So that gives it a kind of different level of legitimacy to good old sustainability professionals trying to persuade the business that they should take certain issues seriously because the NGO community is telling you you should. we take a rather more hard-ass business edge to this. And indeed, the concept of dual materiality is very much present for us as well, thinking about the financial impacts as well as the reputational impacts of topics. So yeah, long answer, but there's a huge amount going on. Hopefully you get some sense of the scale of the agenda that we're trying to address here.
And Rob, not everyone may be familiar with this terminology about double materiality. Do you want to just explain that?
I mean, there's plenty of people that give you a far more legitimate explanation than ever I'm going to do. But for me, it's looking at it through the lens of what is important to the business, what's important to stakeholders, but then also what are the financial dimensions of that and how is that going to affect you in the present and in the near term. One of the things I've always felt about materiality analyses, though, is that they tend to look at the world through the lens of the present as informed by the recent past. And if we were doing this materiality analysis in 5 years' time, applying our best efforts at forecasting, what might it look like? And I think that kind of trend spotting is almost, I wouldn't go as far as to say the third dimension, given the definitions of dual materiality that clever people in the EU and elsewhere are putting on. But I think that time dimension is really, really important.
It's where the place for the increasing use of scenarios in some reporting and disclosure work maybe has a leg. And yeah, I agree, Rob, you've added our triple materiality to the double. A couple of quick follow-ups. We wanted to cover Nestlé's approach to materiality in the Sustainable Business Handbook, in part because of that connection to enterprise risk management, which we thought was fascinating. And you just said, oh, we do it with, but I'm pretty sure that didn't just happen. Who invited who to that party? And how have the sustainability and enterprise risk management teams come to work together on this?
It's funny. It's one of those things that actually, when you look back at it, there's a route there that goes all the way down. I can't remember the name of the guy even. I struggle to remember his name. But way, 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 way back when I was on the outside of Nestlé, but going in and doing consulting work, probably right at the beginning of my days in sustainability, I remember meeting the head of enterprise risk management, and I can't recall his name, but he was curious to know what the public affairs people were up to doing this thing called materiality. And it was kind of like, I want to know what that's all about. And he was a super guy. And that, I think, may have been the beginning of it. And then he subsequently moved on, successor came in. And as is often the case with these sorts of situations, there's a personal interest on the part of the head of enterprise risk management. Her name is Alison Buick. She's head of ERM, but she's also a really passionate, dedicated sustainability thinker. So she wanted this to be part of her remit as well. And then when you've got people that she reports to who've got the good sense to see pretty quickly that actually there is a real link between what's going on the sustainability agenda and the potential risks to the business, then, you know, really it doesn't take too much to bake it in. Good relationships between people, open-mindedness on the part of folk who might otherwise in other organizations maybe be a bit limited in their horizons. And somehow or other, over the course of the last 5 years, it's just become part of how we do things around here. And it's terrific.
And that's perfect, right? That integration, embedding, operationalization, sustainability, not in a corner, the reason you don't have a CSO. It would be, yeah, you know, exactly. maybe too much in one place instead of spread across. We don't mean to only talk to you about materiality today by any stretch. And I know we want to move on. I do want to ask one more thing, though, at least from my side, and we'll test with David too. The processes that Nestlé takes seem incredibly stakeholder engaged. And I mean, that's part of a materiality exercise almost everywhere. But the number of internal and external interviews that your company conducts in the process is exceptional. And I think beyond that, you pull in some consumer and other survey data that's available to you to inform the process. Again, like where and how has this extra emphasis on the stakeholder voice come from?
I think there's a couple of answers actually to that. One is, at the risk of being slightly self-referential, at least two of us on this call have had a hand in this project in the past, some years ago. And indeed, if you go back to my predecessors, thinking about Janet and Christian, both coming from NGOs, having that ability to see the world as others might see us was kind of built into the department that was commissioning the materiality analysis. So this sense of, we have to go and listen to what the world out there is thinking, because if we only do it through internal interviews and a handful of stakeholders, we're only ever going to get a skewed or Nestlé-centric view of what matters. This sense of listening to civil society has just been present for the longest time. You yourself, I mean, you came in and I remember did materiality with Janet all those years ago, right? So I have to imagine that in those meetings, you were pointing out the importance of scanning the horizon and going out speaking to people and so on. And that, again, it just has become baked in. I do get a little bit worried sometimes about how we do this, in the sense that there are certain NGOs, if you speak to them, you know the answer is dot, dot, dot. Now what's the question? So I think we've got to always be mindful of that, that there are some NGOs that have particularly strong focus on certain issues. You have to kind of listen sensitively to that. Some of the internal interviews actually are also really, really valuable to us, because our markets, the folk working in the markets, they have their ears to the ground pretty well as well, you know? So I think that balance between the external world's view and making sure you've covered the ground fully, and one of the reasons why we speak to so many people is that we want to try and make sure that we've given all of the issues as much of an airing as possible, coupled with the market intelligence that we get from talking to people internally, you get something quite powerful out of that.
So interesting. And Rob, I probably haven't thought enough about the Janet Christian Yu trifecta and a succession of outsiders to public affairs running public affairs and bringing a stakeholder bent and experience and perhaps ability to represent that wouldn't be normal in a lot of organizations. You point to my own history of engagement with Nestle, and I actually was working with Hillary Parsons pre-Janet. And so that's interesting. So it was the point of transition from a fully baked Nestle professional lifer to the Janet and series of externals that maybe marks a transition in the company.
I think it does. And I think if you look at the leadership, Peter Brabeck, Paul Bulka, both used to turn up at our grand stakeholder convenings. I mean, they were, I say grand, actually grand's not quite the right word. They were grand in terms of they were big. There's an awful lot of down and dirty people there coming along to tell Nestle what they thought. And I can't imagine any other company investing quite so much chairman / CEO time in attending those events as Paul and Peter used to do. I think that signal from the top was also very much part of this culture of public affairs and stakeholder engagement. And now I'm glad to say we do it in a different way. We don't do those sorts of convenings anymore or those sorts of forums anymore. But Mark Schneider similarly has that kind of, we need to listen to what the outside world is saying. And you don't get that perspective sitting here on the fifth floor of the office in Vevey.
I have to say, as one of those down and dirty outsiders that you referenced, I well remember one or two really interesting sessions, not least when John Elkington clashed with Michael Porter.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was definitely a spectator sport. But listen, I want to move to one of the three initial C's that you talked about from Davos, Rob, was about conflict or about the war in Ukraine and Putin's aggression. We're seeing daily in the international media the impact of the Russian embargo on being able to get grain out of Ukraine. That's being compounded by these exceptionally high temperatures in the Indian subcontinent at this time of year, which is further damaging food production. Now, I saw some horrendous forecasts that potentially 90%, I think, of Egypt's wheat comes from the Ukraine, 80% of DRC's comes from Ukraine. You are representing a global food business. What are companies like Nestle doing to try and mitigate what could be horrendous food shortages?
It's a massive concern that there are several layers to it, time dimensions again. Firstly, there's a whole lot of grain that's locked up, as you rightly say. Odessa is obviously not operational at the moment. There is the possibility of moving some of that grain out by land, but the land corridors are not great, it has to be said. And in fact, you would think the borders would be flowing freely, but of course, conflict has the opposite effect. And so tends to mean that there's actually increased security at borders, which is holding things up somewhat. You've got physical problems such as you can't put huge amounts of shipments of grain on trains because the rails are incompatible, as is being widely commented on at the moment. In terms of trucks, I was listening to a Ukrainian farmer the other day saying that he's got trucks that are queuing for 3 days to get out. So they're then queuing for 3 days to get back in again. That's the 3 day scenario. And then there's the 3 week scenario, which is that he's got 3 weeks worth of diesel left. So it's not just that the grain is stuck. You've got an energy shortage as well because the diesel isn't flowing. So that's the immediate problem with grain. We were talking about this in the week around the possibility of opening up a form of the green corridors that were opened when the COVID crisis hit to try and facilitate the movement a little bit better than it is at the moment. And there's a voice for business there. I'm not sure it's a Nestle voice, but I think there are business representative groups of which we're a part that can make that case. So that's one thing, getting grain moving. The next thing on is the fertilizer problem, which is that so many places are dependent upon fertilizer that's coming out of Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, and those fertilizer flows are really, really stuck at the moment. That's creating a potential problem for the next harvest and the harvest after that that is worrying. I mean, it's easy to say, well, okay then, so that accelerates the transition, doesn't it, to regen ag? Well, it could, but it's not as easy to do it in one growing cycle. Now, does Europe need fertilizer to stimulate 10 tons of food a hectare, or Africa, well, you're getting maybe 3 tons of food a hectare, you know, that kind of relationship. Africa needs it a lot more than Europe does. It's not just that Egypt's dependent upon grain, Africa's dependent for fertilizer. That's a concern as well. So stacking up the concerns somewhat here. In terms of what we're doing about it, I mean, there's some practical things, just basic humanitarian support for a start. I can't remember the top of my head the latest in terms of tons of food donated in Ukraine, but I can assure you it's a lot, which we do through our friends at the IFRC, the International Federation Red Cross, Red Crescent. That, I think, has made a difference. I think it's a matter of public record, so I may as well say it, but we still do have some operations in Russia focusing on infant formula and medical nutrition. And our position is, and at present at least continues to be, that denying people of infant formula or medical nutrition would not be the right thing to do. We've slimmed the operations down in that way. When it comes to some of the other commodities, it's widely reported also that there are huge problems with sunflower oil and other vegetable oils. That's a massive ingredient for us. There is a full-scale reformulation effort underway. Now, reformulation is an easy thing to say, but it's a really quite tricky thing to do because you've got to substitute one oil for another. We have to look at this through multiple lenses. There's the taste profile of an oil. There is the rancidity of the oil, the rancidity level of the oil, the lifespan of it before it starts to go off. There's its availability and its price. And then there are the climate impacts of that oil. We effectively did a kind of league table of climate impact of certain oils. And it's staggering how different they are. Sunflower oil was sitting there pretty much in the middle, comfortable mid-table position. Some oils have got a much lower climate impact, carbon impact. Some are much, much higher. But if you put that together with the other dimensions, you're really narrowing down your options. But we have to do this, and we cannot afford to make rash decisions on reformulation that give us problems with consumer preferences or problems with climate. I mentioned earlier on that we've passed peak carbon. We don't want to go back on that, because we've reformulated many of our products. I mean, there's a lot also that we intend to do, and we'll do this through people like WBCSD and folk at the Food and Land Use Coalition that are working with the UN on the global crisis response groups that have been set up by the UN SecGen. And so there's lots to do there, and we will add our voice to that, and we'll keep working at it. But there's a humanitarian work, reformulate, add our voice, and our procurement teams are applying themselves fully as best they can to try and keep these trade flows going.
That, Rob, was fascinating. I mean, there was the gravity of the situation in Ukraine and its impacts on Africa and other regions in terms of food and food security. But I was so struck that you brought us down to vegetable oil. And in looking at the crisis through the lens of a single product, you reminded us how complex the system that we're trying to transition is. So we won't have regenerative agriculture in a year because it's going to be the task of a generation, but we have to work at it. Maybe that's our way out here today. You started us off with the three C's that had been bouncing around at Davos: the conflict, the climate, and COVID. We've also touched on complexity, without a doubt, and you've made some really interesting connections between ideas. I would like, on the way out, for you to give us a little bit of comfort. It might be a high ask given the state of the world, but I've had the pleasure to know and work with you over the course of decades in a few different places. So I know you've been watching and doing, most importantly, in this field for a long time. I have never felt like things in our space were moving this fast. And there is simultaneously this pressure with the pace that even though there's now this acceleration, we're still running from behind. So as we run from behind and try to close the gap to the big goals out there for 2030 and 2050, what keeps you optimistic that we're going to win this race and deliver the just and sustainable society we've been working for?
Well, I suppose there's a couple of things, and maybe there are also reflections that come from this week a little bit. And firstly, there's a community of practitioners. You said it, you know, we've worked together for the longest time. I met many others that I've known and worked with, and either directly or tangentially this week, and the energy from getting together again and reinforcing each other, I found that actually quite positive. There was something there about that. There was one really interesting moment when I was chatting with Simon Zadek, who goes back similarly. In fact, we first met through him.
Eons ago.
And he was chatting to a young woman. I think the name of the organization is Extantia that she's running, which is a sort of a tech finance sustainability startup. And it just was like so interesting that you got these two somewhat elderly gentlemen chatting to, I don't know, a late 20s, sassy, up and at them young woman with her startup. It was actually all about her. I think that was one of the other things that I took from Davos, the number of young people that just see this not as, oh, I want to get into it because I care about it, period. I want to get into it because I care about it. I've got the best business idea going that's going to really make a contribution and be my livelihood as well. I just think there was a lot of energy around that. That was really good. And then there are other folk. I mean, the number of tech things that are going on, just fantastic. People are starting to invent the things that we need that can help us to go to scale on things like regen ag and measuring carbon in soil and enabling financial flows to reward farmers and so on and so forth. These are the wheels and the oils for the wheels that are going to make all this happen in ways that we used to think, well, wouldn't it be nice if? Well, actually, now it truly is happening. And I guess if there's a closing thought, the breakthrough that we haven't had and the reason why we're still catching up is a simple one. For years, it's been my perspective that we seem to talk about managing sustainability or doing sustainability. No one ever did sustainability. No one ever managed sustainability. And it's why I still have a problem about CSOs, but that's another story. What we should be doing is running our businesses sustainably, managing sustainably, doing our work in a sustainable way. That mindset, that shift in thinking, so that it just becomes part of everyday life, is still a breakthrough that we haven't quite made. But I do believe from the conversations with the younger generation that I had this week, just maybe, it's happening. It might be happening, but God knows it needs to, because it's the breakthrough, I think, that's required.
Everyone doing sustainably, not just talking about sustainability. It's well said. But I'm glad you found some of it on the ground at Davos. I hope you find it on the ground inside Nestle every day as you do the work there. We are so grateful for your time today, Rob. It's been such a pleasure to catch up and to have you bring these perspectives. We'll look forward to continuing this conversation in all the forms that we hope to and want to in times ahead. But for now, thank you so much and have a great rest of your day and a lovely weekend there.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, David. Great talking. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the All In Podcast. If so, don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss any future episodes. And why not also give us a 5-star review on iTunes? It helps others to find us, which helps spread the message.